to Approaching Extinction, Contesting Extinction, and we're going to have our next presentation from Marjolein Ulla.
Thank you. So my paper is entitled Philosophizing Extinction on the Loss of Worlds and the Possibility of Rebirth Through the Language of the Sea. Am I clearly audible? Amid the sixth great extinction, we find ourselves confronted with alarming numbers of loss. It is estimated that about 150 to 200 species of plants, insects, birds, and mammals are going extinct every 24 hours, and that more than 26,000 species of life are currently threatened with extinction. Looking into the future, the scenario is even more dire. The latest governmental panel reports on climate change has predicted that once the level of carbon dioxide reaches 450, possibly by mid-century, humans will have pushed roughly a quarter of the planet's creatures into extinction. If it reaches 400 parts per million, about double pre-industrial levels, we will have caused the genetic extermination of up to 70% of living things. When we focus on the ocean, we can ascertain a range of effects that climate change has had and will have. Due to global warming and the rise of the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the volume of the sea is increasing and various chemical changes are occurring. This results in changes in the level of oxygen, acidification of ocean waters, the sea's metabolism, currents, and much more. Once we realize that ocean acidification was involved in at least two of the big extinctions, that is, at the end of the Permian and the end Triassic period, it is no far stretch to imagine ocean life dying out now as it did then. With the question of extinction comes the question of the meaning of what is or what will be lost. This paper or this chapter's approach to the question of the loss of home and extinction will find its point of departure in a renewed understanding of the concepts of death and loss. I will use the philosophies of German philosopher Peter Sloterdijk and Belgian philosopher Vincent Desprez to argue that the kinds of losses that we face with regard to oceanic extinction are, in the first place, losses to be conceptualized not just on the level of the individual, but on the level of what I call the constellation and the milieu. Secondly, I will argue that the narrative of death and extinction may be reframed as what I call a narrative of revitalization, but only if you follow, as I will argue, Michel Serres' lead in Biogea, who seeks for a new discourse and a new epistemology that is truly responsive to the forces of the life on the earth. I will also turn to Karen Ingersoll's proposal to offer a seascape epistemology that fills in what I think some of the gaps in Serres' ideas. And finally, to add political acumen to Serres' propositions, I will build upon the philosophy of Edouard Glissant to argue that a new language of the sea needs to be fundamentally organized in what I call a multilinguistic and non-hierarchical fashion. So first, on the topic of grasping the meaning of loss. Usually, when we contemplate loss, we think of the loss of individualized beings, such as in Heidegger's famous account of Being Towards Death, which focuses on the loss of a unique being confronted with its own finitude. Peter Sloterdijk offers an alternative account of loss, since he explores connections with others both on a micro and on a macro spherological level. This is part of his foam trilogy, or his bubbles or spheres trilogy. Accordingly, in the first volume of the trilogy, Bubbles, Sloterdijk argues that life is always lived on the intimate level in biune spheres supported by semi-permeable membranes that keep us both protected and open. And in foams, he addresses the macro level as our bonds grow deeper and older and the membranes stretch thinner and more fragile, we can speak of an increased shared existential risk. Thus, moving beyond Heidegger, with Sloterdijk, we find an opening to a more participatory account of death and loss, which emphasizes loss on the level of the milieu, the constellation, and on the level of those who remain. Vincent Desprez extends these ideas to the topic of species extinction. As Desprez recounts the effects of extinction on the passenger pigeon, which we saw earlier during the first presentation, and went extinct in 1914, she argues that what is lost with its extinction, is not just a being, but a contraction, a narrowing of world. What is lost even more fundamentally is that which she calls what makes the world as world, and I'm quoting. But what the world has lost is not what people mourn. What the world has lost, and what truly matters, is a part of what invents and maintains itself as world. This entire universe thinks and feels itself, and each being matters in the fabric of its sensations. Every sensation of every being of the world is a mode through which the world lives and feels itself, and through which it exists. And every sensation of every being of the world causes all the beings of the world to feel and think themselves differently. When a being is no more, the world narrows all of a sudden, and a part of a reality collapses. Each time an existence disappears, it's a piece of the universe of sensations that fades away, end quote. For Desprez, extinction implies a reduction of the constitution of the world as world, a fading of meaning, being, and sensation. If sensation and meaning are associated with the whole, that is the constellation, the world, the living, breathing Gaia, then what is lost is the effect of the passenger pigeons upon the sky, the fact that the sun will no longer be eclipsed untimely by vast dense swarms of them that would darken the sky sometimes for hours, the sensations of wings flapping by the thousands, the play with the wind, and much more. From the inside out, the unique perspective of the passenger pigeon traversing space freely, feeling airdrops on its wings, fighting thousands of wings around it in the air, all that is lost. As Desprez sums up, and I quote, humanity can mourn the passenger pigeon, but it is the world that bursts with its absence, end quote. If you extend Desprez's analysis to the threat of extinction and oceanic changes near my childhood home in the Netherlands, on the North Sea in Zealand, research indicates a shift in terms of cold-loving and heat-loving species. What would happen to the crustaceans living in the North Sea and in the estuary called the Oosterschelde if the pH further dips and their shells dissolve? What if we focus on one of those species of crustaceans, for instance, on the sea snail living in the North Sea shores called the common periwinkle, and in Zealandic we would say krukel. The common periwinkle lives in the intertidal zones, which is above water level at low tide and underwater at high tide. Should this being disappear, but would be lost in its connection to the tides, its immersion and emersion from the waters, its ability to experience both the wet and the dry, its liminal positions on rocks and kelps along the seashore, and its way of grazing algae, not to speak of its construction, of its own microclimate in the sea, conducive to building its own shell. On the human side, the krukel, this periwinkle, has its gastronomic appeal, which is common in both where I grew up, but also in Britain and France and Belgium. And this was also part of my family tradition. I'm now a vegetarian. Collecting, cooking, and eating them. Finally, should we lose the periwinkle, we lose the connecting evolutionary bridge to land snails, and it's tapping into deep time, as it may be assumed that one of the paths leading to the evolution of terrestrial snails went by the ancestors of both periwinkles and other terrestrial snails. Thus, should this being disappear, we lose with it its fluid intertidal existence, holding steadily onto rocks while waves crash above. We lose the ability to close off or open up in the proper circumstances. We lose not only its unique sense of being and its impact, but its impact on a deep and broad web of existence of which it has been part. Similar to Desprez's analysis of the pigeon, passenger pigeon, what may be felt is not just the loss of a being, but the central disruption to meaning as the world narrows and absence echoes through the cracks of what constitutes the world as world. Amid the Great Sixth Extinction, it's hard to escape, thus, the narrative of death and loss. And in many ways, death and loss first have to be acknowledged before we can move forward. One of the ways of moving forward here, I want to suggest, is to follow Michel Serres' philosophy in Biogea, seeking for a new discourse and an epistemology that is truly responsive to the forces of life and earth. According to Sarah, our current language and modus operandi are flawed and have covered over the natural forces, both in the sense of earth or Gaia, and life, bios, obscuring reality for what it is and accessing nature in a merely appropriative, anthropocentric, and calculative way. And I quote, for thousands of years, we've been licking our things with tongues, covering and daubing so as to appropriate things for ourselves. If language boils down to a convention, this convention took place between the speakers without consulting the thing named, become as a result the property of those who covered it in this way with their drawn or voiced productions, end quote. For Sarah, language has not only covered over, but has also made it impossible to sense what he calls nature, reality, or life. Every inert object, he writes, every living thing as well sleeps, accordingly, under the cover of science. Nature and reality have become excluded from perception, and it is this appropriation which covers the world's beauty with ugliness. Sarah's philosophical mission, thus, is to provide new stories that go before and beyond our current language, to tickle our senses once again, to awaken them to the true splendor and horror of the forces of Gaia and Bios, and to seek for a new beginning to our language, to our epistemology, and to our new being, a rebirth, as it were, to who we may become. Before we start anew, however, he argues, we first have to acknowledge the death and dying that has occurred due to our faulty discourse and epistemology. As Sarah is seeking for a culprit at the heart of our extinction, he finds not one in particular, but what he calls the murderous capacity of the multitude. And I quote, persons sometimes kill, the collective always kills, end quote. It's the collective to blame who names and throws objects before us and considers them rejected and disposable. Trash can earth, polluted air, dead seas, soiled by us, for us, to appropriate them, destroyed by a collective that's narcissistic in its turn, end quote. Thus, for Sarah, the goal would be to see again, like the sea, dying, or their rivers weakened, but even more broadly so, namely to sense and think like the entire biogea, the entirety of the earth, and the living species. What Sarah looks for is a new language, one receptive to and born out of the biogea, and the question is, of course, how? He argues that we need to configure it out of what he calls a soft place, as opposed to the hard, where Sarah associates soft with culture, concepts, ideas, meaning, and generally human accounts of reality, and hard with the domain of nature, the given, the physical, the world of objects, of reality independent of human perception of it. And I quote, without this soft place, spiritually very old, but newly conceived in this way, without the juridical construction of a common good opposed to our filthy ownership, I don't see how our planet hard will survive. Hardness that depends on softness, material belonging that depends on this temporary rented location, end quote. In other words, for Sarah, the survival of our world will depend on a new social construction of the soft, with the emphasis on a language that sees commonality rather than individuality, and with biogeological sciences that emphasize interconnection rather than separation, and with words that evoke connections to the sensations themselves rather than covering them up. Sarah asks, can I efface myself enough to let the world ring? For Sarah, silence plays an important role in turning us around, both in, I want to argue, a literal and a metaphorical sense. Sarah asks us to retreat away from the business of the world and its accumulation of human voices, to efface ourselves and mute our own anthropocentric language. We may do so, as Sarah shows, through his own autobiographical descriptions, by feeling the rumbling of the earthquake. He was in the area of Stanford around the Loma Prieta earthquake, by dwelling in the mountains, and by being shaken at sea. He was part of the Navy in his early years. In those instances, Sarah implores us to turn to the fount of language in the biogea, where meaning and non-meaning tumble over each other and where the inexpressible meets the expressible. We may also access this silence in a more metaphorical way by seeking to move away from established languages and the conceptual abyss imposed by the divide between the humanities and the sciences. Accordingly, things should not remain hidden behind subjectivist language, nor remain nameless for Sarah, but rather, they should be, as he argues, be reborn under their code proper name. If we should give heed to Sarah's quest for a language that is responsive to the biogea, and one that is informed by its deeper truths, what would such a language look like? Who or what may guide the way, and who or what may consequently express its danger, its current our current vulnerability to extinction, but also the ability of the biogea to be reborn? Following some of the trains of thought in Karen Amimoto's Ingersoll's book, Waves of Knowing, we could argue that the sea offers an innovative epistemological paradigm for language, an epistemology that emphasizes holism over reductionism and that stimulates us to think, speak, and feel in a more fluid, open, and connected way. Ingersoll, in this regard, speaks about a seascape epistemology, which is grounded on what she calls local ways of knowing, researching, and producing knowledge. As lived and as embodied by indigenous Hawaiians, the Kanaka Maoli, rather than as imposed by what she calls a colonial reality. For her, seascape epistemology is, and I'm quoting, an approach to knowing through a visual, spiritual, intellectual, and embodied literacy of the Aina, the land, and Kai, sea, birds, the colors of clouds, the flows of the current fish and seaweed, the timing of ocean swells, depths, tides, and celestial bodies, all circulating and flowing with rhythms and pulsations. Seascape epistemology embraces an oceanic literacy that can articulate the potential for travel and discovery, for a recreation and decreation. End quote. As we ponder the way forward amid climate change and extinction, Ingersoll's focus on the indigenous act of navigation, ho'okele, at sea brings out the sea as something that one must connect with in order to navigate and survive within. I quote, in contrast with European colonial narratives that relate to the sea as something to be conquered, survived, and at best discovered, Ingersoll thus provides a way forward towards a malleable understanding of borders and coastlines. End quote. Another track for an aquatic language may follow the currents of my problematic Dutch colonial past, back to the Caribbean, the archipelago informed by colonialism whose locale became the illustration of the theme of relation at the heart of Edouard Glissant's Poetics of Relation. Glissant shows us that the profound meaning of this sea-informed place, as well as the repercussions that the slave trade had had on those who arrived there through deep suffering. He emphasizes the harrowing experience with which he begins his Poetics of Relations, which is that of being cast into the belly of a boat, very likely a boat built by Dutch boat builders and merchants, of seeing fellow human beings thrown overboard as heavy ballast to lighten the boat and arriving upon a new unknown land, haunted by the mourning of the former land. He writes, for though this experience made you, original victim, floating towards the sea's abysses, an exception, it became something shared and made us descendants, one people among others. Peoples do not live on exception. Relation is not made of things that are foreign, but of shared knowledge. This experience of the abyss can now be said to be the best element of exchange. End quote. Rather than seeing the experience of the sea's abyss only from the perspective of loss or from the perspective of singularity, Glissant demonstrates that a new future may be built upon a collective memory and a shared knowledge of suffering. Politically, this may allow for hope to emerge out of suffering. It may provide a vision of the possibility of an epistemology that is born out of multiplicity, yet built out of shared knowledge, that is, out of relation. Additionally, and most prominent for my argument here, Glissant argues that the Caribbean formation of language, which also has some traces in Dutch and even Zealandic, offers through its openness a decentered and a multilingual way to think and live. The genius of the Creole language consists, for Glissant, in the following ways, and I quote, "In always being open, that is perhaps never becoming fixed except according to the system of variables that we have to imagine as much as we define, Creolization carries along then into the adventure of multilingualism and into the incredible explosion of cultures," end quote. Rather than synthesizing differences into a concentrated unity, the power of the multilingualism that Glissant addresses lies in its ability to multiply, to be organized non-hierarchically, and to vary time and again. Thus, a aquatic speech act, such as emerging in the Creole language, show that a new language of the sea need not be romanticized or subtly reference nature, or be referenced solely through traditional ways of being, but with Glissant we come to recognize that a language of the sea may evolve geographically, naturally, culturally, with hyphenated Heideggerian hyphenation there, out of a variety of stances, out of an erratic mixture of languages, and thus may carry with it horizontal power structures extending into the future, with no one language being ascertained as the center of hierarchy. Creolization, as Glissant's commentator Drabinsky clarified, is, I quote, "a passage that works against conventional models of transition. Diffraction distorts, bends, and chaotically reconfigures. Accordingly, the diffraction of which Glissant speaks may add a helpful caveat insofar as any imagination of a future language of the sea should not be monolithic nor hierarchically organized." Transitioning to the conclusion. If it is the case, as Wittgenstein argues, that to imagine a language is to imagine a form of life, then it is the task for philosophy in the Anthropocene to think through possibilities of a new language, or better said, new languages that are both informed by the loss of world as world, but also trusting that new forms of life and culture may emerge. To forge ourselves collectively forward, the model of the seagoing pact, as Sarah relates to it, may serve as well. "Without a seagoing pact," a quote from Sarah, "the collectivity of sundered immediately exposes itself to the destruction of its fragile niche," end quote. Similarly, the success or failure of our own endeavors to navigate the troubled waters of the Anthropocene depend upon the formation of such a pact, ideally formed in solidarity. As we seek a global response to climate change and extinction, this image, I argue, of collective navigation may guide us, I hope, to safely connect to other shores. Thank you. The silence of which Sarah speaks.
Thank you. I have a question about Michelle Serres' critique of collectivity and your ending on that hopeful note about collective navigation. And it might just be in this context or my reading recently, but I find Sayre's critique or his use of the we is rather like narrow and myopic, and so I wonder the kind of collective that he's critiquing, which I think is really a European collective culture, but he doesn't name it as that. And so, but the way the quotation I read from him reminds me of Simone Weil's critique of the collective, you know, that the collective is just bad and violent and that will obliterate individual thought. But clearly you also see the collective as something hopeful. So, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, I think you're right to point out that Serre, in many of his books, sort of talks about the problematics of the collectivity, and in his book The Natural Contract, which I haven't cited here, but which I think is also very much in the background of my thought, he argues, for instance, by that we have struck a contract, a social contract, and of course there's a big social contract theory in philosophy, but we haven't struck a natural contract. So we need to supplement our current social contract with a natural contract, which would mean that we would revise in many different ways our way of operating with reality. As he's talking about that social contract that's very much associated with the Western European civilization accordingly, and what he's trying to do, though, is as he's rethinking language, is to think about if language is spoken by multiple people, then it is sort of a way that sort of does unite us and does unite us with nature again in a way that allows us to, again, sense beings in a way that sort of allows them to hear their voices. The pact that he talks about is very much the pact that he's thinking about of how you survive on a ship, right? These are not massive collectivities. These are kind of solidarities as they're formed, as you're trying to protect each other, protect your journey, whatever goal you have there. So I think the collectivity that I'm quoting there at the end is of a different kind of nature, one that sort of knows solidarity. It is in some sense similar, it has a similar kind of mission, but it also is very elemental insofar as on that journey, on that ship, you are connected to the elements. You're feeling the forces of the waters and its dangers, its currents, and the winds. So it is a collectivity that is in solidarity, has a common mission, but that mission is aligned with the elements around it. So I think that that is, I think, very important. And connecting it up to Simone Weil, I think they're both very critical of this collectivity. At the same time, both of them have a very astute attention, astute focus on paying attention. And I think especially in Biogea, what he's trying to do there is, in his autobiographical encounters or narratives, he's allowing us through his own voice to pay attention to the forces of the rumbling of the earth as he had them. And I feel that's kind of a similar moment as you find it in Simone Weil, where she's talking about the importance of focusing upon schoolwork, like that very focused attention on what it is that you're being allowed to see. So yeah, there are similar tendencies in them, and of course with Serre it turns much more than Weil to the natural world.
Yeah. Can we, just staying on that topic for a minute, could you talk about the difference or compare the collective on the ship that Serre talks about to the collective on the ship that Glissant talks about? Because it seems like, you know, both might be in relation to nature, but Glissant's idea of how the collective gets formed on the ship as a collective memory is a memory of being in the hold, right?
Yeah.
So it's these people are enslaved, and they're not sort of part of a collective that's all the people on the ship together trying to, you know, deal with nature. So those collectives are very, very different. How do you think about that? I mean, I think it'll be interesting tomorrow too, because we're talking about Ryan's paper, which is about the Zong ship crisis. Yeah,
that was a painful thing to read, how that ship had been called Zor or Care. And now it's called Zong, or what in Dutch you would say, one sang. It's the past tense of singing. I find it interesting. And I think oftentimes there are tendencies in Michel Serre's writing that make him seem to romanticize nature. When he talks, for instance, about sort of the soft and the hard, it's really sort of easy to sort of say that he wants us to go back to the hard and not recognize the soft. But the quote that I cited is to say that he thinks a survival of the hard, that is of what really sort of underpins our world, is only possible through the soft, that is through language and culture. And he does not specify how that happens. And I think in that regard, Glissant fills that insofar as he says, our culture and our way of being is built upon not just on dying seas, but it's built upon dying bodies that were collectively shipped and sold accordingly. So in many ways, I think Glissant fills in what that place of the soft is, namely, if you have to do justice to reality, then you have to also remember what has happened, not to us all collectively, but on that very local level, to peoples. And what I think is very helpful there too is with the Sant, right, this moment of collectivity that's born out of shared suffering disperses itself into many different kinds of fragments, just as to say or to nuance Sarah's idea of a one language. There will be a new language, but that new language should have multiple shapes, such just as there are many multiple kinds of cultures. And of course, as you're thinking about the Creole language and in contradistinction with the French center of power in the French Caribbean, then you know that offers really a helpful mode of sort of non-hierarchical and decentered kind of language formation, and of course also a model of resistance. And I think at times Serre sort of pulls us back to sort of key motifs, but doesn't yet connect us to the political in the way that I think Lee Sant really does with articulation. We hope that satisfies it.
In a sense, I'm just following on from Kathy's question, but also from the presentation before by Abigail and Leonardo, and just the kind of question, just maybe to sort of flip the question of power back at you. And, you know, so what you're suggesting is the kind of Bresson's thought almost kind of provides this addition to kind of Western, and there's a collapse scene there in terms of ontology and the kind of flattening that we all kind of go forward with these sort of additional, whereas you've got a kind of, in kind of Bresson's term, a very painful history that actually that thought of Heidegger's Sloterdijk and so on are built on the white supremacy of kind of you know, that has created this, you know, kind of those histories in the Caribbean. So I'm just kind of wondering how you address power, and so that it doesn't just become a sort of another kind of accumulation, that we get a new ontology to kind of address Western thought with, that, you know, so what do we do about these kind of power differentials and these kind of questions of these painful histories that have been kind of marked by extinction and very intentional extinction that other systems of thought are kind of based on, but always constantly erasing?
Yeah. That's a hard question. I think if I were to further elaborate on this paper, right, then I think, as I've sort of alluded to it, right, sort of the personal dimension of my own country and its colonial past has to come into view a little bit more clearly. But also, of course, with some nuance insofar as if I would be focusing on sort of the province of the Netherlands where my family is from, then I think if I would unpack it a little bit more in terms of its language and its dialects, and to sort of pose that as sort of a model of an, in one way, in position of power, at the same time also being under duress of sort of the monolingualism of Dutch. If I could sort of reshape, right, sort of these different ways of how language operates in both the colonizer and the one who's being colonized, then I think my argument would acquire a bit more precision so that it doesn't become these sort of anonymous power centers, but there becomes sort of, I would inflect my account with a bit more ambiguity in terms of the transformation of these. That's not to say, right, that, and that's also what my question was earlier on, is sort of how are we thinking beyond localities towards solidarities on a broader scale? That's not to say that, you know, that Netherlands would not escape blame, or as we're thinking about what it has done to the Caribbean, or may continue to do so. But it also, at the same time, would destabilize comfort centers of blame and of power as these different localities has morphed in different ways. And the part that I didn't read of this paper, right, was about the flood that hit Zeeland in 1953, and it has personal resonance for my family as well. And of course, that's an aspect that I did not elaborate as much, right? But as we're thinking about power centers, right, and we're thinking about the decentering power of climate change, then what may we learn of certain kinds of flood as they affected some of these superpowers in Western Europe and what may we learn of that as an as another way of destabilizing so-called powers in politics. Not quite, maybe, I don't know if I'm quite answering your paper, your question, but in a sense, right, as I'm thinking about your question with regard to how I further want to develop the paper, that those are kind of the thoughts I've had. I don't know if that you think is productive. But.
I have a thought along those lines.
Okay.
That it seems like there's a, I really enjoy the idea of Creole as creating these sort of, having this liberatory potential or this possibility for connecting in new ways, and that there can also be a look toward languages that are old, you know,
yeah.
that are you know, traditional languages like the Miami language, which I mean I read about Ojibwe, which is related, I believe, to Miami, right? That that the gendering in Ojibwe is not to do with constructions of sexual identity, but to do with living in what's living and non-living, and that by far the majority of nouns are to do with living. So, you know, one's grandmother in a tree would use the same would be the same gender, you know, and also maybe like waterfall. So the idea being that the ways of seeing that are embedded in languages are available in languages that have been colonized and that have been harmed by colonization,
yeah.
or reduced by colonization, but that there's a lot of availability there to think with as we try to think about extinction. So I think that would be a really interesting direction to go. I also thought a much more sort of Western kind of or like a romantic poetry anthology kind of way of thinking about these things. I thought about William Blake, you know, he's a radical, right? But William Blake from Auguries of Innocence is thinking about this at the very beginning of your paper with the beautiful, beautiful passages about the passenger pigeon and the sea snails,
mm-hmm.
And those affective relations and observant relations to the world that are like that are, you know, closed out,
mm-hmm.
and disappear from the possibilities of the world. I thought that was just a beautiful, beautiful way of thinking about things. But Blake has this quote, or from Auguries of Innocence, he says, "How do you know but every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight closed by your senses five?" And it always struck me that, like, being closed, he doesn't say closed to your senses five,
mm-hmm.
he says closed by your senses five. And I've always wondered whether this was a like a way of thinking about, you know, if your senses are actually what closes you out from being able to imagine what the bird is seeing and experiencing, then there's something about it's a critique of empiricism, kind of. It's a critique of the limits of the observable, and that there are other. And I felt like this idea of the soft might be a place where that kind of territory. So this is a very, very kind of blurry comment I'm making.
Right. Right. No, I find those comments very helpful. I mean, I have only cast a glance on this, but they're recently arrived in my book box, a book called An Ecotopian Lexicon, which sort of tries to define new ways of or older ways of describing our natural world. And I think as much as we can sort of think about new terms, I'm thinking about Glenn Albrecht's term for sort of mourning and loss in the Anthropocene, celestialgia, as sort of a helpful new term to get us to grasp what it is that we find ourselves in the home that have completely sort of shifted in terms of meaning. But I also think you're right that there are really helpful ways of returning to older languages that do so. I think in that regard, Imamoto Ingersoll's work is really important there, but I need to carve a little bit deeper into that language of land and sea to see how that would operate for this writing. I also think, right, if I turn to my own past, and then I have some queries out there too in terms of Zealandic how there are prior ways of relating to land and sea before building dams, and as one thrives in fishing communities and isolated islands, what that was like. I think that's another deep and profound way of maybe not getting as poetic as Blake, but to get at some of these other ways of grasping a connection to the elements. Yeah.
Hi, thank you for your paper. It was really insightful. So I just have one question and it's a comment on your work. I only read once Michel Jesser, so I'm quite familiar with him to talk about his work. But you just mentioned like a second ago different ways to relate to languages or revitalize ancestral languages. So my question / comment is that in order to do so, we will have to redirect our intentions / also efforts, because that entails also that most of the non-Western languages, indigenous languages or ancestral languages, there is no space for capitalism and or industrialization and monumental modernity, it Cohen, Robinson, right? So in that way, we will have to destructure the structures that basically that we're speaking of,
yeah.
Right? So if we want to incorporate or we want to revitalize indigenous languages and everything that comes with it, we will have to recenter the human, yes, but also we will have to decenter the market economies that we're living in, and also capitalism. So instead of mentioning Anthropocene, we will have to start like discussing capitalism and start like deeper discussions on the consequences of colonialism and the deeper consequences of racialization and genderization of the societies that we're living in. And I don't think it's a matter of blame, but it's also a matter of start deconstructing the same structures that we're living on right now. Mm-hmm. Because yes, we can have Creole language classes, and we can have in Brooklyn, and we have in Manhattan, Lenape languages classes, we have Quechua, Aymara, et cetera, and other indigenous languages and or ancestral languages, but it also entails that all the cosmopolitics within the languages, and there is no space for the structures that we're living on right now, including language production, including language dissemination, and including also several structures that we are relying on just to be like here, for example. So I don't know if you have any take on that.
Actually, it's at the forefront of my mind. So another, this is part of a bigger project on loss, and one of the chapters that discusses, for instance, fire and the devastating nature of fire in California, and it discusses the myth of Prometheus and the problems with industrial fire. And within that context, I talk about sort of the blame game that's going on with the electricity company in Northern California called PG&E and how it's had to declare bankrupt. And people are pointing their fingers there, but of course it's part of a much bigger kind of problem, and that problem is capitalization. It's capital. It's also the problem of privatization. It is the problem of sort of suspending common property as it was held. Not overall in all the tribes in California, but there were different property regimes. Other than private property as we have it, so it's really interesting. And I think if I were to make it more precise with regard to property, right, then you would have to go back to older accounts of how the sea also has been divided up, right, and how it has become part of these claims about property. And in that regard, I want to tackle in many ways the same argument that you have, but with a bit more focus on how property affects certain elements, such as fire and water and sea. But there's lots of interesting accounts of how it came to be that the seas were also seen as being divided in different kinds of ways. And with that, I can then tackle the argument, but I think I need to move through the specific elements themselves, but I'm very much on board, and the more I've been presenting my topic, the more people have said, you know, you need to really elaborate the political dimensions of this project, which is, I think, is born out of phenomenology, but has a very political direction as well. Thank you. Yeah.
I had a follow-up question. Thank you for the presentation. in a way in which English language envisioned as an ecosystem talks about sort of being implanted in other spaces and then sucking up nutrients and self-curing capacities and then creating these hazardous fire-ridden ecosystems.
Yeah.
This idea in which language is not simply a reflection or a sign of historical violence, but language itself can be a form and a practice of violence.
Yeah.
So I was interested in hearing more about sort of talking about this non-hierarchical language. Is there space in that argument also for sort of the, I guess, the active resistance or even reduction of certain languages that are in themselves sort of causing violence actively? And I had kind of an entailed question to that too, which was about Poulissant's writings on creolization in terms of opacity and sort of a demand for opacity. And also, is there a space in this sort of non-hierarchical language to not be able to hear, or sort of to acknowledge that one can't decipher the language in some ways?
Yeah. Can you remind me the question of the act of resistance in those dominating languages?
Yeah, I'm sorry, that was a poorly phrased question, but it was drawn from Mbuyu Watiamu's metaphor of the eucalyptus tree.
Yeah.
And the idea that languages themselves are not necessarily a reflection of violence, but actively produce violence. So in a sort of space of non-hierarchical language, is there a way, or do some languages need to be actively combated, for instance, like the English language?
Well, thank you for those questions. I mean, in a sense, right, Glisson's answer with regard to his emphasis on the Creole language is that French needs to be combated as sort of the center of attention, right? So that I think is really worthwhile to as a point. But of course, it's a point that is in opposition. I mean, I think it comes out of a very political position. It also comes out of a position of how it was lived, right? French was the language, and you wouldn't be doing your academic work in another kind of language. So I think, yes, but of course, it's also more nuanced. I think if there is something problematic about what languages may share beyond sort of their geographical boundaries or national boundaries, right, then I think he would point us to the Cartesian vocabulary, right, of being masters and dominators of the earth, right? So there is sort of a common shared difficulty with many of these kinds of languages, whether it's spoken in Lockean terms or whether it's spoken in Cartesian terms. That sort of points us to essential problems. So we should also not be confined to specific languages, but you know, what are we trying to get at when we're sort of thinking about nature as a subject to be dominated, and that would be pervasive in many languages, at least in Western European culture. As for the demand for opacity and not being able to hear, I do think that if we would follow Sarah's trace of this ability to start finding new ways of saying things, then you have to start in that opacity. Right, you have to really tune everything out. He himself also talks about his own practice of writing and how he has to really literally sort of, you know, keep the noise out. But I also think he's really thinking about really sort of be confronted with your own silence and relearn listening. And whether that means listening on a, as you were mentioning, on a very sensorial level or on a different level, that I think is the question. I'm thinking similarly, right, of Lucy Irigaray's claims for silence, and that any true encounter between two people, in her account, the interpersonal, to truly connect to another person, you have to silence your own voice and the other one as well. And in that encounter, born out of silence, can you mutually construct a new language, possibly? So I think, yeah, you have to start with opacity. You have to start with nothing in some sense. At least attempt to go there. If it's truly possible, I don't know. But that's his gesture. Yeah.
Yeah. I will try to formulate a question. But more than a question, is actually I was thinking when you were giving your talk about a certain point you talked about mute anthropocentric language. You used the word mute, not even silence. And then if there is any connection or if you can elaborate with how can we use language and not use language, how language can actually look at the sea, probably, as an example of being silent or silenced, and how actually language can be decentered and be less anthropocentric.
Yeah. Maybe I'll try to explain it through how Serre operates in Biogea. I mean, of course, he's a non-conventional philosopher and he's not read in many philosophy departments. One of the ways that he tries to get across certain concepts is by telling stories. And his way of telling stories is sort of a way to sort of mute the usual philosophical discourse and at the same time, right, to let concepts emerge out of this encounter on a ship or on the River Garonne or on a walk in the mountains. So in many ways, right, the muting happens as one sort of walks away from the general discourse and tells stories about encounters. So it's more on that, what he calls the incidental level, the accidental level, the sheer encounter that is surprising, that that we can track reality. Now language, of course, is a much more systematic, if one wants to say, if it's shared. But he would want to argue, right, that as we are trying to formulate that language, that it has to happen not out of a planned, programmed effort, but it kind of has to, again, emerge out of these accidental encounters where we're truly sort of reverberating with things. He thinks that everything in the world has a language or has a code. That's his name. That's his term for it. Coding and being coded in a building or a fish or a human being is happening all the time. So the question is to pick up on that code. And one way of doing that is to find yourself immersed in something that kind of destabilizes your usual way of being. And I think in that regard, he's also trying to destabilize himself, philosophy, by turning to truly philosophical stories that are not easily captured in bigger kind of concepts. A roundabout way of getting at your question.
Yeah. I think we're out of time. The next event in this room is, the next event for the public is at 4:30. It's Catherine Youssef's keynote. So please come back for that and we'll see you all soon. Thank you so much.
Right? And I was thinking about, I don't know if you know this recently.